Good morning to this second day opening session. As we said yesterday, we have to stick to the program and try to be on time in order to make this machine as a program to work properly. So since you have all in your folders a brief presentation of the curricula and the trajectory of all the people presenting in these panels, I will skip that, and I will simply give the floor and simply present in a very simple way the panelists in today's first round table. We are very happy to have, as you can see on the screen, Teresa Bayen from Oxford. Very happy to have here in person Michael Scholby as a panelist, and Andrew Williams too as a panelist in this round table. I stop simply here. Teresa, you will be the first to talk. As we said, 20-25 minutes for presentation. You all three will have this 20-25 minutes presentation, and then we will give the floor to the audience in order for questions. Teresa, thank you very much for being here. It is a pity that you could not make it to be here. Next time we will have greater success. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Juan and the other organizers, and I'm really devastated that I can't be with you all. Unfortunately, it's the first week of term here in Oxford, and if you've ever experienced the Oxford system, the only way to describe it is mental. So it's pretty mental here at the moment, but I'm glad to be able to join you at least virtually. I'm also, as someone who works or whose work is more historical, it is always an honor to be included and welcomed among the philosophers, especially my esteemed colleagues on the panel. So again, it's just really good to be here. Now, in my comments today, I'm gonna focus on a special issue of the journal Modern Intellectual History that I recently co-edited with two of my colleagues, Sophie Smith and Annette Zimmerman. And which is now, if you go online, you can find it. It's now available online first, but it will be published officially later this year. Now, the special issue began life as a conference held at the University of Oxford in 2017 to mark the 15th anniversary of Rawls's death. And now with the vagaries of edited collections and academic publishing, it will now appear just in time for the centenary of his birth. So it's taken us a while. But it means also that we get to participate in these wonderful discussions about the 50th anniversary of A Theory of Justice as well. And as we note in our introduction, it's the case that today Rawls remains almost as popular as he ever was among political theorists and philosophers, but his work in his life are now squarely subject for historians too. And since his death, a rich body of scholarship has emerged, which attempts in different ways to understand the nature, the development, and the impact of Rawls's thought from a historical perspective. And so in the special issue, what we're trying to do is to focus directly on this emerging phenomenon of what we call the historical Rawls. Now, efforts to historicize major figures in political philosophy are sometimes, maybe even often, dismissed by political philosophers themselves as little more than antiquarian interest. And so historians of political thought like myself are really familiar with the request that we explain why our findings should matter to our more normative colleagues, for whom studies of context, although they may be interesting, sort of are assumed to hold little normative or philosophical import. But I think one thing I just want to point out, and we point out in the volume, is that the current push to historicize Rawls is coming from, for the most part, from scholars like myself who actually consider ourselves to be political theorists first and foremost, and not intellectual historians. And so this is true very much of the essays in our forum, which look at the implications of their historical reconstructions for Rawls's treatment of issues from race to the market to theodicy. And so I think it's really important to think about how and why historical understanding matters for political philosophy and theory. And that's something that I want to kind of raise in my talk today. But I also just want to note that in writing about the historical roles, we're also kind of writing or commenting implicitly on the politics of historical writing. And so I'm just going to flag, you know, a couple of things. Firstly, the stories that historians can tell about a figure like Rawls, or really any figure in the history of political thought, is going to be constrained quite significantly by what people have chosen to preserve. And those people include Rawls himself, i.e. what he left to be preserved in his archive. And at the same time, the stories that historians of political thought and intellectual historians tell are often informed by assumptions that the scholar herself is making about what the point of historicizing is. So sometimes, you know, scholars will set out to vindicate some aspects of Rawls's theory or to debunk it. Sometimes we might want to recover past possibilities or paths not taken, which I sort of, the way of doing the history of political thought that I most associate myself with. But we might also think that sometimes historians are motivated by a desire to exorcise Rawls's ghost from the discipline. And that's a metaphor fully embraced by Katrina Forrester in her recent book, In the Shadow of Justice. So my own personal contribution to the issue, I decided to focus basically on Rawls's own appeals to history, to sort of figure out what Rawls himself thought about the role that historical understanding played in the practice of political philosophy. And so in the article, I look both at his published works and his teaching, but in my remarks today, I'm going to focus on his teaching on the assumption that that's sort of less well known generally among political philosophers than the published works, which tend to, you know, we tend to be able to cite chapter and verse in a way that certainly isn't the case with his lectures. All right. Now, sort of the looking to Rawls himself as a historian of political thought, or looking at to how he put historical understanding to use in his work, may seem at first like a really counterintuitive thing to do, because even, you know, among political theorists who disagree on pretty much everything, we all tend to agree, nevertheless, that what Rawls did in 1971 was introduce an emphatically sort of new approach to the political philosophy that was resolutely contemporary, normative, and forward-looking. As one eminent political philosopher at our 2017 conference remarked, that as a graduate student at Oxford in the 1990s, quote, one read Rawls to avoid reading history. So resistance to historicizing Rawls on the part of those committed to seeing things his way is, I think, really understandable. And to treat him simply as one more figure in the tradition to be contextualized and criticized accordingly does seem in some way to undermine the decisiveness of his break with tradition, or the kind of ostensibly ahistorical way in which he approached political philosophy. Now, having said that, though, it's also really pretty well known that Rawls himself was a remarkable traditionalist. A theory of justice appeals routinely to the tradition of political philosophy in se, while linking its arguments to the tradition of contractarian thinking. In his lectures, Rawls argued consistently that political philosophy was itself an essentially traditional, as he called it, pursuit in the remarkable continuity of concepts, texts, and basic questions over time. So again, so since the latter is less well known, I'm going to focus on the lectures. And specifically, I'm going to focus on lectures that were not published. So many of you probably will know the collections of his lectures in the history of moral philosophy, his lectures in the history of political philosophy. I'm really focusing on lecture notes and syllabi in the archive from the sort of long span of his teaching career. So that began in at Cornell in the late 1950s, and then famously continued through his long running career at Harvard, in which he taught both of these survey courses, and particularly Philosophy 171, which was the survey course on political philosophy. Now, I think we look at the published versions of the lectures versus the successive drafts and notes preserved in the archive, we can see Rawls's views of the tradition of political philosophy, both what he took it to be and how he proposed to teach it, that these changed significantly over time, and they changed in ways, I would argue, that are reflected in and significant for understanding the changing aspect of his political philosophy over time. And here I'm talking about from a theory of justice to the kind of changing orientation of political liberalism, and then Injustice is Fairness, a Restatement. Now, before I dive fully into the lectures, I just want to foreground some historical context that's relevant. It's pretty well known that the stage for theory's reception in 1971 was set by a famous remark made by Peter Laslett in 1956 that, and I'll quote it for you, quote, "For 300 years of our history, there have been men writing political philosophy in English." And again, it's men and they're writing in English. But now Laslett lamented, quote, "The tradition has been broken. For the moment anyway, political philosophy is dead." That's a very, very famous declaration. Less famous, however, is that not everyone took the news of the death of political philosophy lying down. Most notably, in my account, John Plomonats, who was a professor at Nuffield College, Oxford, in his 1959 address to the Political Studies Association, strongly objected to Laslett's declaration of the death of political philosophy and argued that, quote, "The great thinkers are always worthy of study, not as a stock of ideas sufficient for our purposes. They're inadequate for all sorts of reasons, but because we still have to come to terms with what thinkers in the past did to make up our minds about them if we are to learn to think more clearly than they did about political questions." So there, Plomonats is saying, not only are we continuing to do political philosophy, but in doing political philosophy, we're always required to engage with this tradition of theorizing that sets the stage for our own theorizing. But what's also distinct about Laslett is that this isn't a kind of antiquarian or historicist approach to the history of political philosophy. Laslett has a strongly supersessionist view. We need to know about past ways of thinking about of doing political philosophy, primarily so as to think more clearly and supersede them. And notably in that talk, Plomonats insists that, okay, well, I may need to know something about the historical context in which a figure thought and wrote, but surely I don't need to be a specialist in it. So he says, quote, "Just because I need to know these things, quote, I hope that doesn't mean that whoever discusses these historical theories must also discuss the conditions and controversies that produce them. Is there no division of labor, right, between historians on the one hand and philosophers on the other?" Now, Plomonats is most remembered today, I think, certainly among historians of political thought, as being one of Quentin Skinner's chief targets in his famous essay, Meaning and Understanding in the History of Ideas. And based on Skinner's critique, I think it's often assumed that there's some kind of fundamental tension between historical approaches to the history of political thought and contemporary analytic approaches to political philosophy. One of the things I argue in my essay, and I think it's really important to recognize, is actually these approaches to political thinking are totally consistent and mutually supportive. I mean, both historians and philosophers on this view regard political philosophy as kind of having a history in the way that physics or geology or biology has a history. You know, it's a history mainly of errors, false starts, and dead ends. The time has come for us to do our thinking for ourselves, as Skinner put it, and to leave the history of political thought safely to historians. Okay, so much by way of background. So that Skinner's essay was published in 1969. Plomonats' essay was published 9 years before. When A Theory of Justice was published in 1971, it appeared straightforwardly to accept Skinner's division of scholarly labor, which was actually a kind of radicalized version of Plomonats's, the idea that philosophers should philosophize, historians historicize. So the purview of political philosophy for Rawls in that work appears to be entirely presentist, but at the same time, Rawls is evidently eager to insist that his own theory does not in fact constitute a break with tradition. So I've already mentioned the famous appeal to the contractarian tradition in theory, but I would also point to neglected features of the text. For instance, Rawls originally intended theory to open with an epigraph from Rousseau's Emile. which is not very well known. That was only killed in the pre-proof stage. And then the example I find particularly interesting is the point early in chapter one where Rawls actually plagiarizes Gregory Vlastos in the process of arguing that justice as fairness tallies with tradition, i.e. it's consistent with the political philosophical approaches to justice dating all the way back to Aristotle. So if you don't believe me that Rawls plagiarized Vlastos, I encourage you to have a look at my article. So I think the fixation on continuity in 1971 is really significant, and it's significant too because it's in contrast, pretty stark contrast, with the more straightforwardly analytic articles in political philosophy and philosophy that Rawls had been publishing hitherto. And I argue in the paper that Rawls's approach to the history of political philosophy changes decisively in and around 1958, which just so happened to be the very first year that Rawls was called upon to teach a survey political philosophy course to undergraduates at Cornell. And so at that point, it's 13 years before theory, but at that point he's already engaged in the process of writing what will become a theory of justice. Rawls's lecture notes begin to reflect a familiar excitement of a young teacher who, in explaining a difficult work to his students, is actually forced to read it for the first time. I'm sure that's familiar experience to many in the room. So Rawls's early lectures not only offer his first sustained treatment of contractarian thought as a tradition going all the way back to Plato and even the pre-Socratics, they also contain his earliest reflections on the nature of political philosophy. So Rawls's conviction in these lectures that the history of political thought alone is insufficient training for political philosophy is striking, and that's consistent with the kind of arguments that Plamenauts is making. But so is his insistence, like Plamenauts, that political philosophers can't do without history either. Rather, students must begin by situating themselves within one historical tradition or another, and by, quote, subjecting that tradition to criticism and scrutiny in finding one's own way to truth, unquote. So Rawls himself presents what he's doing. He presents himself in these earliest lectures as, quote, a utilitarian of sorts. He identifies with that tradition and claims to be working from within the tradition of utilitarianism to reflect, criticize, and improve upon it. The essential point here, I think, is that beginning at Cornell in 1958 and then ending with his retirement from teaching at Harvard in the 1990s, this is sometimes mentioned, but I don't think it's actually taken sufficiently seriously, is that Rawls will consistently organize his survey history of political philosophy courses teleologically. That is, he'll present historical material as following an inexorable trajectory that culminates in his own works in progress. And so initially, what he's doing at Cornell and Harvard is signing chapters of what will become a theory of justice to his undergraduates. And then later, he's going to start assigning chapters of what becomes political liberalism, and then finally, justice as fairness, a restatement, as the culmination of these survey courses in the history of political philosophy. This approach remains consistent throughout Rawls's teaching life. And what we see if we look at the evolution of the early lectures is that Rawls moves from sort of talking about the political philosophy as a matter of traditions, i.e. utilitarianism, contractarianism, et cetera, to this more unified and perhaps even ecumenical approach, saying, well, actually, political philosophy itself constitutes a single tradition. And then he begins to present this in Philosophy 171 when teaching thinkers starting from Aristotle to Marx as all contributing to a single, quote, tradition of democratic thought, right? So this idea of presenting the trajectory of historical thinking as a unified and progressive tradition of thinking towards democracy. Now, I've already noted some similarities in what Rawls is doing in the lectures to points that Plamenauts had made in 1959, It's unclear whether Rawls actually met Plamonauts at Oxford when he was a Fulbright scholar in the early 50s. But certainly once Plamonauts' essay was published in 1960, Rawls begins to take copious notes on it and immediately incorporates Plamonauts' arguments into his lectures. And I'm just going to cite one particular, I think, provocative example, which many of you may not know about. So Rawls says, quote, "If political philosophy seems quiescent today, it's because few practical political problems call for it." And here he takes the example of racial segregation in the United States. He says, quote, "Racial segregation has no moral defenders. It is a psychological and sociological problem of getting people to act as they overtly think they should. Thus, the leading political and social questions of the modern age are in our country, i.e. United States, in a sense resolved," unquote. Now, hereafter in his lectures, Rawls makes his already teleological approach to tradition explicitly Hegelian. And the archive reveals that Rawls himself was the first person to analogize John Rawls to Hegel's Owl of Minerva, and that's all the way back in 1960. But in any case, we already see that in his comments on racial segregation, right? The problem is basically solved. It's now just a motivational issue of getting people to behave as they know they ought to. But this can actually be the beginning of political philosophy, because like Hegel's Owl of Minerva, we're now in a position to think more clearly and make progress in political philosophy. Now, in 1960, Rawls clearly understands the rebirth of political philosophy in his day as continuous with a tradition of what had come before and not as a radical break from it. Nevertheless, he continues to approach political philosophy in theory and in the lectures as a kind of Plamonautsian supersessionist enterprise. This changes decisively in the later 1970s and then in the 1980s. And again, we see this reflected in his published works. In the 1981 Tanner Lectures, Rawls appeals consistently to the wars of religion in the 16th and 17th centuries as the historical origin of political liberalism, a claim he expands upon in Political Liberalism Itself. And in my article, I argue that the impetus for Rawls' shifting approach to the tradition of political philosophy is once again pedagogical. So this turn to a history of contexts and questions is something that begins in his lectures in the 1970s, in the late 1970s, and it seems to coincide with his personal friendship and acquaintance with Quentin Skinner himself when they were both at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton in the late 1970s. And the correspondence there is really interesting. And it also seems to be that Skinner also introduced Rawls to the work of R.G. Collingwood and the logic of question and answer in the history of political thought. And that's something that Rawls appeals to explicitly in his published Locke lectures, with which some of you may be familiar. In any case, I'm not going to suggest that Rawls became a card-carrying Skinnerian historian of political thought. He clearly did not. He thought that the questions that political thinkers asked remain remarkably consistent over time, et cetera, et cetera. But I just want to conclude by just saying a bit about what I think that we political philosophers maybe want to take away from this history. Martha Nussbaum recounts a story about a meeting in the 1990s between Rawls and a PhD student working on utilitarianism in the Harvard Philosophy Department. And it became clear over the course of the conversation that the student had never read Bentham, he'd never read Sidgwick, nor any other historical proponent of the view. And so when the student left, Rawls reportedly lamented, quote, "What a pity that that man is so poorly educated," unquote. Right? So pedagogically, at least, Rawls remains an unapologetic traditionalist throughout his career. He insists that adequate training in political philosophy is going to require sustained attention to the tradition of political philosophy too. And although he never explicitly defines what he means by tradition, the concept captures something that Rawls saw as intrinsic to political philosophy itself. As he put it to a student in the 1960s, quote, "You are part of a tradition. Place yourself within it." So sort of knowing where we are and where we're starting from seems essential for Rawls in beginning to philosophize about politics and making any progress in that pursuit. So we need to know where we are, and we also have to have some awareness, it seems, of how we got there. I think that's really the key point if we're going to philosophize adequately. Now, when it came to teaching political philosophy, I think I'm at the end of my time, so I'm gonna wrap up. But when it came to teaching, Rawls's emphasis on the tradition remains consistent, although his understanding of where we have to begin and approach the tradition changed significantly. But what doesn't change is where we are going, right? The teaching remains teleological. It's always oriented towards presenting the trajectory of the canon as constrained by the telos of secular liberal democracy in the United States under the Warren Court, specifically, with each writer, even Marx, contributing to the development of democratic thought and culminating in the works of John Rawls. And so I'll just conclude by saying, reading Rawls as a canonical figure in the history of political thought is thus not a repudiation of his project at all. It's rather a continuation of his project in the process in which he was an active participant, this process of canon construction and presenting himself as part of the canon. And in offering his students advice on how to approach figures like John Locke, Rawls is pretty clearly also offering them advice on how he himself would like to be approached. So he says, in looking at a text, quote, if you are to get as much as you can out of it, you must try to interpret it in the best and most interesting way. There is no point in trying to defeat it. Otherwise, I think it's a waste of time to read any important philosopher. Unless we follow these guidelines, he says elsewhere, quote, we fail to treat them as conscientious and intelligent writers who are in all essential respects, at least our equals, right? So I would say just to my fellow political theorists and my fellow historians of political thought, the question facing readers today is not thus not whether we should historicize Rawls, but how viewing him as a figure in the tradition of political philosophy might lead us to read him differently. And in this respect, Rawls's teaching offers insight into how he himself would have read John Rawls as a canonical figure in the history of political thought. Moreover, it reveals that he spent a lot more time contemplating that question than one might think. Thank you.
Okay.
Is that better?
Is that okay? Thank you. Just indicate if I mumble or you can't hear. I'm going to talk about social mobility and social justice. So just to focus our minds, supposing that a political community assigns jobs through a competitive market procedure that makes citizens' employment opportunities depend upon two things. One is their different family and class backgrounds, and the other thing is the range of jobs available. Right? Obviously, it's a very simple example. And just to focus our minds more, imagine that this community can choose one of two policies which have an impact on either the reduction of head starts for privileged people who come from family backgrounds or class backgrounds, which equip them to compete for jobs particularly effectively. Or instead, the community can increase room at the top so that there are just more jobs available. Like, say they can either choose funding schools, which leaves the range of jobs unchanged, but mitigates the impact of social origins on success. Right? So when we do this, we increase the opportunities for the less privileged, and we reduce the opportunities for the more privileged. Instead of that, we could fund research in order to accelerate technical change and to increase our economic growth in a way that expands the range of jobs, but exacerbates the impact of social origins on success. Right? Perhaps privileged people are particularly well equipped to compete for the expanded range of jobs. But let's assume that everyone has better job opportunities when we fund research than if we fund schools. Right? So assuming we can choose only one of these two policies, what does political philosophy say? Right? Does justice permit only one policy, or does it permit both policies? Or perhaps does justice favor in one way, or all things considered, one of these two policies? Right, so that's the question I want to address. Now, here's the agenda. I'm hoping that, like me, you'll be a little bit conflicted when you face this choice. I'm hoping that you think that in order to resolve this conflict, we need to identify the basis and the strength of two different kinds of claims on social institutions, or complaints against institutions. A kind of comparative claim that individuals be as well off as other individuals, and a non-comparative claim of the form that people should be better off than they otherwise would be. So that's my kind of organizing idea. And now, since this is a conference on Rawls, and since Rawls has so many interesting things to say about this, I'm going to focus on the answer that Rawls gives in A Theory of Justice. I'm going to argue that the implications of justice as fairness, Rawls's theory of justice, are less obvious than many of us assume. I think many of us assume that Rawls's principles affirm a comparative claim that favors funding schools. And I'm going to say that that overlooks the fact that Rawls's opportunity principle, in fact, opposes only some inequalities in opportunity. That's only part of the story, because we should recognize that Rawls's view also contains non-comparative claims. It affirms a stringent but satiable principle that requires meeting basic needs. Rawls talks about a social minimum in A Theory of Justice. In political liberalism, he's even more explicit when he says that first principles covering the equal basic rights and liberties may easily be preceded by a lexically prior principle requiring that citizens' basic needs be met. He adds, certainly any such principle must be assumed in applying the first principle. Right? So in fact, there's a kind of background principle that social institutions, the first responsibility they have, even before perhaps protecting liberal democratic freedoms, is to meet basic needs. Now that matters for our dispute, because if citizens have certain basic needs for occupational opportunities, and those needs would be fully met only by choosing research rather than choosing schools, then Rawls' view opposes choosing schools. Even if choosing schools distributes opportunities more equally than choosing research. So just by way of background, I should say why this kind of issue exercises me so much. My wonderful teacher, Jerry Cohen, described himself as somebody with impeccable proletarian credentials. I think of myself in the same way. When I was growing up, I didn't meet any middle-class people other than teachers or doctors. My great-grandfather was a street sweeper after being a miner. His son was a bus driver. And my father was a fitter and a turner in a steelworks. So when I think about this issue, non-comparative claims are really important for me. I think institutions have very weighty reasons to make it the case that people have opportunities other than being a street sweeper and a miner. These are really hard jobs. And if you're on the left, I think you should be concerned about that. I was always very puzzled why Jerry was so preoccupied with equality and neglected, I thought, was a requirement of justice to expand opportunities for people. So that's kind of one of the reasons I'm interested in this. The other thing, though, is that I do think that comparative claims matter. I do look at Catalonia, Spain, and the UK, and I think that there are so many unjust inequalities in opportunity. And then I kind of think, well, that must matter. And I want to understand why it matters, really. So that's the thing that kind of exercises me in this paper. The worry is that the natural explanation of why it matters, which appeals to a very standard reading of a theory of justice, is in fact a mistaken reading. So my worry is that perhaps we exaggerate the extent to which inequality and opportunity is an injustice. That's by way of background. Let me say then what the standard reading is. I'll move fairly rapidly here because I hope that it's familiar to you. You'll all recall that Rawls states his second principle of justice as follows. Social and economic inequalities are to be arranged so that they're both reasonably expected to be to everyone's advantage and attached to positions and offices open to all. Right? Rawls assumes that we should understand that second idea of positions being open to all in terms of a principle that operates on a free market system that satisfies basic liberties. Now, he dismisses one relatively conservative understanding of what it is for positions to be open to all, natural liberty. That's a view that just requires careers open to talents and legal prohibitions on certain people entering the competition for jobs. And in the place of that principle, he offers a liberal interpretation of what it is for positions to be open to all, which he elaborates as follows. I won't read the whole quote, but when explaining this idea of fair equality of opportunity, he says, those who are at the same level of talent and ability and have the same willingness to use them should have the same prospects of success regardless of their initial place in the social system. The expectations of those with the same abilities and aspirations should not be affected by their social class. There's a complication because the basic liberty principle allows individuals to form families, and that may result in variations in human capital formation. But at least class, on this understanding of fair equality of opportunity, is an impediment to the achievement of social justice. We have to eliminate class-based inequalities in opportunity. And he mentions various ways in which we could do this, like funding a publicly funded school system. Now, I think that this, as I said, is the standard reading. Perhaps that's just because I spend lots of time with people who work on family justice, and use of this slogan appears so often in the debate about the family and equality of opportunity. But I think it's an inaccurate reading. And if we look at Rawls's later final version of his two principles in A Theory of Justice, we'll see that Rawls makes an interesting qualification to his opportunity principle. Right. In section 46 of A Theory of Justice, Rawls affirms what he calls a priority rule, according to which an inequality in opportunity must enhance the opportunities of those with the lesser opportunities. Right. This principle emerges from Rawls's discussion of Keynes's view that inequality was necessary for capital formation. And Rawls says, this wouldn't be a justification for inequality if capital formation merely maximized the sum of benefits. But in fact, if capital formation was best for the least advantaged members of society, the Keynesian justification for inequality in income and wealth would be a sound justification. It would show at least that inequality was permissible, even if not required. Rawls then uses this very same reasoning when he's talking about the specific good of opportunity. He says, the inequalities in income and wealth that Keynes had in mind also violate the principle of fair equality of opportunity, that is, as it was previously stated. But he says, that doesn't show that the inequalities are necessarily unjust. Right? Appealing to remarks by Burke and Hegel, Rawls says that many writers hold that fair equality of opportunity would have grave consequences. And his response to this is to say that if those grave consequences really reduced the opportunities of the least advantaged, made them have fewer opportunities than they needed to have, that would have implications for social justice. It would mean that the inequalities could be permissible according to the opportunity principle. Right? That's pretty clear when Rawls says the priority of fair opportunity, as in the parallel case of the priority of liberty, means that we must appeal to the chances given to those with the lesser opportunity. We must hold that a wider range of more desirable alternatives is open to them than would otherwise be the case. That is, if we're going to justify inequality in opportunity. Like, strictly speaking, the remark I've just quoted states only a necessary condition on inequality in opportunity being permissible. But the fact, Rawls says, he's adopting a parallel view to the view that he applies to basic liberty has implications here, because in the case of basic liberties, he says fairly clearly that if there are inequalities in basic liberty which are really necessary to enhance the basic liberties of those with the lesser liberty, that renders those inequalities in basic liberty just, or at least not unjust. So I think, really, if we're strict Rawlsians, and we want to adhere to the view that Rawls takes in A Theory of Justice, and I don't think he contradicts it in later work, we need to recognize that the fair equality of opportunity principle, in its final version, permits inequalities in opportunity, provided that they enhance the opportunity of the least advantaged. And that might well be true, because if we look at the work of economists and sociologists, they'll say that the large increases in social mobility that took place in the post-war period were a product of basically expanding room at the top via economic growth and not by reducing gaps in opportunities between the least advantaged and better off people. Because one of, at least in the British case, if you look at work by people like Goldthorpe, then you'll see that the prospects of success, the relative social mobility has remained really low, as my own experience confirms. So how should we respond to what I've just said? Like, everyone knows that there are two responses to a philosophical argument. One is, oh yeah, that's ridiculous. The other is, so what? Right. I've tried out this talk with three people so far. I'm very pleased that Roberto Gargarella yesterday gave me the oh yeah response. But the majority of my audience, that is Paula Casal and Tom Parr, have just given me a so what. Why are you spending 20 minutes to tell people this is the case? So some people kind of have that kind of reaction. And they say, look, this isn't a dirty secret. Right? We shouldn't be embarrassed about recognizing that the prevention of inequality as such is not an adequate reason to level down opportunities. Moreover, it's not even a secret, because any minimally close reading of a theory of justice recognizes that Rawls applies this kind of efficiency-friendly Parisian reasoning, not just to income and wealth when he affirms the difference principle, but to the distribution of basic liberties and the distribution of opportunities. So really the only thing that's accurate in your title is that this is a little result of not very great importance. Talk about something else on Friday. It's a bit disturbing, but on the other hand, I do want to say that many people are opposed to existing inequalities in opportunity. And life would be much easier for them if there was a plausible principle of social justice that provided a robust, that is, as Cohen would say, fact-independent critique of those inequalities. So I think the observations I've made, if not quite a secret, or at least an inconvenient truth. Right? Really, this is a plea for help to tell people like me how we should respond to them. Moreover, I do really think it's the case that these observations are not sufficiently widely acknowledged. Right? I know the literature fairly well, and it's massively more common to see people talk about Rawls's slogan than to talk about the possibility of mutually advantageous inequalities in opportunity that enhance the opportunities of the least advantaged. So I do think in some respects, even if it's not quite dirty, it is an embarrassing kind of secret. Moreover, you might think it's one of those secrets that people don't disclose as a result of some hot mechanism, right? Just because it is inconvenient. So, on the other hand, and to end on a more positive note, I do tend to agree with people that we shouldn't overestimate the magnitude of this secret. Even if the opportunity principle in its final version does permit inequalities in opportunity that enhance the opportunities of the less privileged, empirical investigation may, and I think does show, that many actually existing inequalities in opportunity don't have this property. Right? We could remove them if, in a way which didn't suppress the expectations of the least advantaged. I think if you had more use of lotteries in admissions to elite universities, then the least advantaged opportunities would increase. The other thing to say is that even if the equality of opportunity principle doesn't condemn inequalities in opportunity as such, perhaps there are other elements in the Rawlsian system that can be invoked in order to perform that task. Who knows, perhaps a concern with democracy and the fair value of the political liberties, or perhaps a concern with stability can get the same results. And finally, perhaps there are other theories of justice which have been developed as a result of Rawls's amazing work, which get the more egalitarian result. That's something worth thinking about. So my final conclusion is that this is a secret that's small enough for us to share without diminishing the critical potential of Rawls's amazing work. Right? And I hope you will share it with other people for me and report back what you find. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you all for being here to hear me this morning, and thanks to the organizers for what I believe is a terrific event. I'm only sorry I wasn't present for the discussions yesterday. I'm going to discuss what I think is a difficulty, a problem in Rawls's political liberalism that I believe has not been identified or discussed much before. And I'm unduly optimistic. I'm hoping for a reaction besides the two that Andrew mentioned, neither so what nor oh yeah, but you're right, and which I suppose is the greatest aspiration, right, that a philosophy talk can have. So I want to begin with some material that I hope is mainly reminders to most of us who are familiar with Rawls's work. So we see in Rawls's work two dimensions of what we might think of as practical reason or practical rationality. One of these is designated reasonableness. This is an attribute that the individuals Rawls is envisioning in his political philosophy have, wherein it's closely associated with their sense of justice. A reasonable individual, a reasonable individual, a reasonable individual has a capacity to comply with and identify principles of fair, mutually advantageous cooperation, conditional on other people doing the same. It's an acceptance that others have conceptions of the good that it's rational for them to advance. You are only one among many individuals in society, and so you should recognize that others have conceptions of the good that it's rational from their point of view to want to have realized. And the constraints of Rawls's original position are appropriate, in his estimation, for selecting principles of justice because they embody reasonableness. That is to say that those individuals in the original position are seeking to find principles that, to govern the society that they will be living in that they all can accept. But alongside this notion of reasonableness is the other dimension of what we might think of practical reason from Rawls's point of view, rationality. And he sometimes uses the phrase rationality in the narrow sense. And this is associated with our capacity to form, revise, and pursue a conception of the good, that understanding of our lives according to which we would think it goes well. And individuals in the original position are to exercise this kind of instrumental or strategic rationality in pursuit of their conceptions of the good. So the task that Rawls assigns individuals in their original position is to select those principles of justice that will most fully advance their conception of good, of the good, pardon me. Subject, of course, to the constraints of the veil of ignorance, right? They don't actually know, right, what their conceptions of the good are, and they don't know many other things about their talents, abilities, background, you know, status within society, and so forth. So we have these two aspects of our practical reason, or Rawls often calls these our two moral powers. And there's been a lot more attention, I think, with respect to Rawls's work on the reasonableness side of the ledger than there has been on the rationality side of the ledger, right? A great deal of discussion about what exactly Rawls has in mind by reasonableness, or what a reasonable conception of the good is. But it's for Rawls, I think, this notion of reasonableness has a particular dialectical or argumentative significance. It reflects and preserves, right, the pluralism about the conceptions of the good that he takes to be emblematic, right, of the modern circumstances of justice, right, the kinds of societies that Rawls is theorizing about or theorizing for are societies that have a plurality of different comprehensive views, right, a variety of different conceptions of the good operative within them. And the aspiration, then, of the theory is to be neutral among those conceptions of the good, at least sort of at a fundamental or foundational level. So there's been a good deal of discussion, I think, about the significance of reasonableness, what Rawls had in mind by it, and so forth. A lot less, I think, or to my observation, about rationality. And so the questions that I want to pursue here are about how liberals and Rawlsians in particular should understand rationality. And I want to pursue this question of whether there's a single conception of how to be rational, or as I'll put it here, how to be prudent, where I take prudence to be the virtue associated with this kind of rationality. Or are there many such conceptions? And is it possible for a liberal Rawlsian state to then be neutral, right, with regard to prudence? So the objectives for the presentation are, first, I want to explain what I take Rawls's conception of prudential rationality or prudence to be. Then I want to raise the problem that I think Rawlsians face regarding reasonable pluralism about rationality. And then I want to conclude by suggesting that I think this is a fairly challenging and formidable difficulty for the Rawlsian program, that if we end up with a kind of reasonable pluralism about prudence, that is to say, if we end up acknowledging that there are many reasonable conceptions of prudence, rival conceptions of how to think about prudential rationality, this may make the liberal program difficult to pursue or to justify. So the conclusions that I want to advance are these, that I think Rawlsian liberalism at least adopts what we might call an economic picture of prudential rationality that's defined by five precepts, and I'll explain those precepts in a moment. But I don't think that this economic picture is uniquely reasonable among possible conceptions of prudential rationality. There would be other ways of thinking about what it is to live one's life prudently that seem to me to be reasonable candidates for a good life. And so if the Rawlsian liberal insists on this economic picture of prudential rationality, this is at odds with liberal standards for political justification, right? So political liberalism aspires to giving justifications of political principles and institutions that are neutral and in a certain way public. I think this is a pretty difficult problem, but I think it may well be an intractable problem. Finally, that reasonable pluralism about prudence, which I think is the position we should adopt, seems implied by certain liberal commitments, but I don't think that this will give us anything like clear or determinate principles of justice in the end. So let's see what Rawls has to say about prudence. Again, he says much less about rationality or about prudence than he says about reasonableness. But we do get, throughout his writings, I think, hints, right, as to what prudence is supposed to consist in. So in Political Liberalism, he speaks of the rationality that the agents in the original position are supposed to exhibit. He says that we're to suppose that the parties are rational, where rationality, as distinguished from reasonableness, is understood in the way familiar from economics. The parties are rational in that they can rank their final ends consistently. They deliberate guided by such principles as to adopt the most effective means to their ends, to select the alternative most likely to advance those ends, and to schedule activities so that ceteris paribus more rather than less of these ends can be fulfilled. So I think we see here at least three precepts, okay, of Rawls's conception of prudence. So an agent is prudent because, and to the extent that she exhibits, first, a consistency in the ranking of her final ends. I take it that this is an appeal to the notion of transitivity, So if among your ends are A, B, and C, and you would prefer the realization of A to the realization of B, and the realization of B to the realization of C, you prefer the realization then of A to C, so transitivity is obeyed. There's instrumental efficiency in the choice of the means that one uses to pursue your ends. You don't choose means to the realization of your ends that will make them or make their fulfillment more remote. You choose those that make them more likely, and even better, make them maximally likely. And then you, I guess, sort of organize your choices in time. I'm not sure exactly what Rawls means by scheduling here, but you schedule your choices in terms of the time at which you make them and perhaps the energy with which you devote to making those choices so as to maximize the fulfillment of your ends. Perhaps this means that you decide that there's a certain sort of choice that needs to be made, today, whereas another can be put off, for next month, next week, whatever, okay? So we have three precepts, I think, suggested in that one passage. But another precept, I think, is suggested here. There we go. Another precept is suggested here in A Theory of Justice, where Rawls appeals to the notion of temporal indifference, right? So he says in this particular passage that we are to be indifferent, right, with respect to when our preferences are satisfied, right? So he says that in case of an individual, as he puts it here, pure type preference is irrational. It means that he's not viewing all moments as equally parts of one life, okay? So the thought here is that a prudent individual is not concerned with when in their lives a particular preference might be realized, but merely that it's realized. You don't have a preference that a particular preference be realized at age 60 as opposed to age 20, right? Of course, all kinds of causal facts there, right? Some preferences can't be satisfied at 20 or at 60, right? But in and of themselves, you don't have a preference for when those preferences are themselves satisfied. This, I think, in turn echoes Rawls's famous separateness of persons criticism of utilitarianism, right? You may remember that in that passage, Rawls says to us, well, the utilitarian begins with a plausible view about individual prudence and then wrongly extrapolates that to collective decision, right? As if deciding, right, how to distribute resources among individuals or opportunities among individuals is akin to, right, deciding when to put the satisfaction of a preference in your own life, right? As if, our relationship, the relationship among the individuals in this room, say, is like my relationship to different time stages of my life, right? And he thinks that's a pretty clear mistake. And then the final precept is that prudence is exercised in the service of a life plan, right? Sometimes I've heard people say that Rawls' conception of human life is kind of careerist, right? You sort of set out at a certain point in life and you've got this plan you're trying to realize. I think that exaggerates things a little bit. Rawls does acknowledge that your life plan can be revised. It's not, the case that the aspiration you had when you were a 18-year-old first-year university student, is fixed for forever and all time. But nevertheless, you're supposed to be pursuing over the course of your life a revisable life plan. So I think we have these five precepts suggested by Rawls as defining or constituting what it is to be a prudent individual. This is what, if you will, the virtue of prudence would manifest itself as. Again, consistency in the ranking of your ends, instrumental efficiency, this kind of scheduling of your choices across time, but a temporal indifference to when your ends are fulfilled, and then organized or anchored in a kind of revisable life plan. Now, what should we say about this economic conception of rationality, right? Well, I think my own view is that it's certainly not unreasonable, right? It could even be true, right, that this is the right way to think about prudence and the right way to think about rationality and the rationality of individual choice as we go about the pursuit of our ends. But I think the issue at hand is whether it's uniquely reasonable, right, among possible understandings of rationality and prudence. Now, I think this question is a relevant question, an important philosophical question, because the Rawlsian liberal society is going to be organized around, right, the normative authority of economic prudence, right? So we will have different principles of justice, various institutions that are aimed at and embodying and realizing those principles of justice. And the assumption is that the subjects of justice, you and me, either are prudent in these ways or we agree, right, to be treated as if we are prudent in these ways, right? That it's fair and right and proper for the state to view us, right, as prudent in the ways that I've just described to Rawls. And the worry here then is that if the answer to this question is no, that the economic conception is not uniquely reasonable, then I worry that liberalism has a problem. It seems to run afoul of its own justificatory standards, its own standards about neutrality and publicity, right, with respect to the justification of principles and institutions of justice. So, what are some alternatives, right, to this economic conception that I think we can recognize? Well, one possibility here is that your understanding of prudence might allow for temporal discounting, right? I think a good many of us actually view the remote future as quite unpredictable, or we're really not quite sure what our aspirations and goals and values will be 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, 50 years down the road. And we might well prefer a smaller reward relative to our present ends over a prospective larger reward later. Or maybe on the other side of the fence, perhaps you are a figure that I'll call the Proustian nostalgist, right? You're really preoccupied with what's happened to you in the past, and you want to preserve various sorts of things and goods that were realized in the past, or your memory of them, or something like that. And you just really don't worry too much about, various sorts of goods that might be realized in the future. So I think temporal discounters are one sort of counterexample to this economic conception. Another one, bohemians and slackers. These are folks who are who give pride of place to spontaneity, right? Their life plan is one that they're quite willing to set aside or jettison for the opportunity to be spontaneous. My wife was joking with me once that, she says that I should be more spontaneous, and I said to her, well, my plan is to, do 10 spontaneous things tomorrow. Right. Now, maybe this is not me, but the bohemian or the slacker, right, prefers spontaneity to planning, right? Sort of a more devil may care kind of attitude. A third sort of counterexample, many of us, I think, are narrativists or life shapers, right? So many of us seem to think that certain kinds of moments in our lives matter to us more with respect to well-being. We want our lives to have a certain sort of shape. You might just consult your own intuitions at this point. Would you prefer to have a life that begins with a very high level of well-being and then steadily declines, right? Or would you prefer to have a life that begins with a lower level of well-being and it steadily increases with the supposition that the overall amount of well-being in those two lives is the same, right? So just, are we doing this or are we doing this, right, more or less? I think many of us do have preferences, right, for when we want different events to occur, in part because we have preferences regarding the temporal location, right, of the realization of our ends. And then finally, didn't want to get ahead of myself there. A final example, I think, is sort of what a figure we might call the Buddhist non-striver, right? This is someone who thinks that sort of the maximization of the realization of your ends is self-defeating, right? That, in fact, exacerbates suffering. As soon as you realize one of your ends, some other desire kicks in your psychology, and you have some other end, maybe equally powerful, exerting its motivational efficacy over you. And it just never stops, right? We kill off one desire, fulfill one end, another one comes in its place, and since this is a source of suffering, this is just not a very good way to live. So these, I think, are all sort of counterexamples where I would say that individuals have reasonable, right, conceptions of prudence that are at odds with the Rawlsian view, right? Again, the Rawlsian economic conception. Okay. So are these rival understandings of prudence or rationality unreasonable? Are they so irrational that they can be ignored? I think the answer here is no. Keep in mind, again, the question is not whether this is correct, but whether they're so unreasonable that they should be excluded from our theorizing about justice. Right. I think we can raise doubts of a kind of Humean sort about whether there really are requirements of practical rationality, requirements of prudence, requirements whose violation, right, amounts to or elicits properly the charge that we are irrational. I guess I have some doubts that this is in fact correct. And I think that this raises a serious difficulty for the Rawlsian program. I think we can view the problem here in one of two ways. In some ways, I think that different views about prudence are parts of people's conceptions of the good, right? I think when we ask people about what they think makes their lives good, one element of their response will often be some sort of invocation of a view about prudence, right? About how to go about making decisions, about how to go about relating to different moments and events in your life, and so forth. Alternatively, right, you might think that conceptions of prudence are, if you will, freestanding, right? That they're a sort of conception or a norm that we subscribe to that isn't part of our conception of the good, but is nevertheless certainly a governing aspect of our psychologies. But either way, I think it's fair to say that reasonable disagreement exists about the nature of prudential rationality, and I think that liberal requirements of neutrality and publicity speak against, right, just sort of unthinkingly or uncritically, right, incorporating the Rawlsian conception into our theorizing about justice. Okay? I'll skip a little bit ahead here. I think one way to see the problem here is that we can imagine the original position reformulated, right, by reference to what I'm calling here pluralism, right, about prudence. How would that unfold? Well, if individuals in the original position know what their conception of prudence is, that is to say the one that they will have in the society that they're theorizing about or deciding for, well, that's one possibility. The other one is that they don't know their norms of prudence. If the first is the possibility, they can tailor the principles to their respective conceptions of prudence. This seems to be in violation of fairness or reasonableness. So if you do in fact embody Rawls's economic conception and favor then, right, like the Maxime-Min principle, that's what Rawls seems to think you'd favor, then you can tailor it to your own particular conception of prudence. If you don't know, then I think you're simply at a loss what principles to choose, right? I don't know. Am I a Buddhist non-striver? Am I a Rawlsian economically prudent individual? Do I temporally discount and so forth? Then it seems to me that you simply won't be in a position to know what principles of justice you can select. In any case, I worry then that I think liberalism either is stuck on in a sort of dilemma, either becomes illiberal when it denies reasonable pluralism about prudence, or I think it's stuck with an indeterminacy regarding the principles of justice. And I have to say, I'm not seeing a way out of this thicket. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Now it's time. We have a quarter of an hour. We should stick to the program. Therefore, we will give the floor to the audience. I merely ask you to put direct and concrete questions, please, and remarks and other things might be put to the panelists outside when we have the coffee break. So, there are three here. Here. Please, Andreu. Aquí davant. Aquí davant.
Just a quick question to Andrew. So, once you interpret the fair equality of opportunity principle as a Maxime-Min principle rather than as equality for given talents, then doesn't that lead to collapsing the two parts of second principle? Because and we no longer need the notion of social position. And so in fact, what you want is simply to have a Maxime-Min-ing of the social and economic advantages listed in the difference principle.
Question for Teresa. Thank you so much. I wanted to pick up on your last point about it's not what... Closer. Okay. That it's not whether, but how we contextualize rules. So you've looked at the Skinnerian approach of situating Rawls as he wants to be situated, kind of vertically in the tradition. But another Skinnerian approach would be to ask, what's Rawls doing in his moment? So in the former, it's the case of Machiavelli innovating on Cicero, and in the latter, it's Machiavelli writing a job application in the form of the prince. So I wanted to ask what these two different methods have to offer for exercising the ghost
which would be more effective, and or whether there's some other contextualizing methods, ideology critique, Marx, you name it, which you think might have more bite.
Thank you to all of you for these great talks. My question is for Michael. So I was very happy to see your talk because I've wondered about the same thing. And I wanted to make two brief remarks. The first is on the slide where you sort of split the split the slide down the middle where you say, here's pluralism about reasonableness and pluralism about rationality. I was thinking what you put under pluralism about reasonableness still belongs to rationality, really, because it's a pluralism about rationality, because it's about, you know, different conceptions of the good, which falls under rationality. There is such a thing as a pluralism about reasonableness emerging in the very late Rawls, right? And namely, once we talk about a family of reasonable conceptions. Then there's the criterion of reciprocity, sort of, as the limiting condition. The other thing I was wondering is if maybe sort of the thing you pose as a problem might be actually the solution, namely that, or maybe that's overstating it, but maybe there's reasons to think that in the original position, under the particular choice situation there, a kind of single conception of rationality is permissible. And that's compatible with granting that actual people here and now might have a variety of them. This is merely suggestive, but just to indicate that I thought this was really great, and maybe this is a way to go, I don't know.
So the last one. Now there's a question for everyone.
Yeah, thanks. So my question is also for Andrew, and it's related to Philippe. So. I also thought that it seems like what your argument would suggest is that we should kind of conceive of opportunities as just one of the primary goods that the second principle kind of requires applying the Maximin principle to, and maybe it's particularly important. But then I wonder if the solution to the kind of intuitive sort of problem that you propose is just kind of the one that Jerry Cohen proposed with respect to economic inequalities, and maybe it's kind of even more plausible once we realize there's kind of a structurally similar problem for opportunities, right? So namely, what we need is kind of an ethos where people are willing to voluntarily make choices that will promote equality of opportunity, and then you can get greater opportunities for the less well-placed without having to accept very large inequalities in opportunity that favor the better placed. So just curious what you make of that thought.
Wonderful. Thank you for sticking to. So I suggest the following order: Andrew, then Teresa, and then Michael.
Okay, thank you. So in response to Philippe and Brian's suggestion that my view favors a maxi-minimizing principle that just focuses on the least advantaged social position and doesn't draw a distinction between income and wealth and opportunity, I think that's an interesting but an important mistake. I don't think present in a theory of justice is the idea that we should just distinguish social positions and then look at the least advantaged position and maximize its prospects. But that is in Rawls's considered view. Certainly it's not the view in Justice as Fairness. And that's because I think he does care about benefit promotion, but I think he has a kind of satiable benefit promoting principle. So the idea is we have to promote people's promote advantages, but up to a certain threshold, And then what we should do is apply a Parisian egalitarian principle that says we can have more or less benefits provided that the benefits are fairly shared. So in other words, we can just go up the production curve and we have discretion. Right? We're not required to produce the largest amount of benefit for any particular social group. But it needs to be the case that inequalities in the benefit produced are not detrimental to the least advantaged. Now, that's not a maxi-minimizing principle. That's a benefit-promoting principle that says get to a certain level, and then after that, society has discretion about how much further benefit gets produced, provided that the benefits are fairly distributed. There are no detrimental inequalities. That view is consistent with what I said in the paper. I also think it's the more plausible view, and that as kind of green leftists, we shouldn't be favoring maximizing income and wealth. I think that's a huge political mistake. So that's the response to that. Now, the further question about the difference between these two primary goods of income and wealth and opportunity, I do think work is special. That creates, so I'm open to the idea that we should give priority when we're evaluating the value of an opportunity set for the least advantaged. What opportunities for work and productive endeavor are given to people in that. So I realize there's a problem with liberalism there. We want to have a suitably publicly justifiable view. But that's why I wouldn't want to just assimilate income and wealth and opportunity. So I'd love to talk about this more later.
Thank you. Teresa, now I will give you the floor.
Shall I start? Okay. Yeah, thanks for that question. And I'm sorry I can't continue to discuss this with you after the panel. But I just note that in the question, you sort of assumed that what historians of political thought want to do when they approach Rawls is to exorcise his ghost from the discipline. And I would just say, you know, as I sort of mentioned my remarks, I don't presume that's the case. And certainly in my own work, I don't think that exhausts what I'm up to. But yeah, I mean, on the point of are there other contextualist approaches that pack more of a critical bite? Absolutely. And one of the things that Sophie Smith details in her contribution to our volume is just how many Marxists and other critical theorists were offering contextual readings of a theory of justice from the very beginning. Right, so using historical context as a kind of critical lever into interpreting the text. But in terms of the two kinds of Skinnerianism that you quite rightly pointed to, the idea of the sort of monumental, maybe sort of high-minded canonical form, and then also the kind of quotidian, everyday, Austenian form, right? This idea, you know, what is an author doing in writing a text? I mean, I would say that in my own work on Rawls, and also in Brandon Terry's contribution to the edition, the volume, which is focusing on Rawls and race, and actually criticizing Charles Mills on his reading of Rawls and race, what Brandon and I are doing is trying to bring the kind of canonical and quotidian together. I mean, one way of saying that is that in approaching the history of political thought himself, in employing it in his teaching, Rawls is doing something, namely he's engaged in constructing a canon, but also to what end? Well, the end is, again, sort of cementing the sense in which a certain form of political liberalism is inevitable as a step of progressive political development. And specifically in my essay, and in Brandon's as well, we're interested in how this changing approach to the history of political thought is then reflected in this more consensualist method that we see in political liberalism. And then finally, I would say just the sort of turn to a kind of small c conservatism in the way that Rawls presents the task of political philosophy and justice as fairness. Perhaps it's a very controversial thing to say, but he says, you know, political philosophy needs to respect the limits of possible, of the possible. It cannot simply condemn the world. And I think that's really we can see that changing and sort of in potentially even, you know, understand better that those sorts of comments if we look to contests. But I would say on a final critical note, I do think, I mean, so obviously I'm part of this kind of insurgent generation of historically minded theorists who want to historicize Rawls. And in doing that, we're doing something critical. But I would say that I personally reject some of the work of this type that I think relies sometimes on insinuation rather than argument. I mean, we see this with some work on Rawls. We see a lot of this in some work on Foucault, too. Just so the idea, well, you know, contextualizing is actually a way of sort of insinuating that something unsavory was going on. And so I do think as historians and political theorists, we always need to be very clear about kind of, you know, what are we arguing? What are the normative criteria? And sort of, you know, if we're critiquing, sort of what is the critique? Not just sort of saying, well, just implying that something unsavory was going on. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. So I hope that what came through in the presentation is that if liberalism takes seriously pluralism about prudence, right, in the same way that it takes seriously pluralism about conceptions of the good, say, that this generates a difficulty liberal standards of justification seem to rule out, right, certain conceptions of prudence, right, or seem to be unable to rule out particular conceptions of prudence as sort of candidates, right, for you know, the conception of prudence that we might use in theorizing about justice. Or, as I said, we end up with a kind of indeterminacy, right? We just don't know what principles of justice ought to be applicable. And you suggested that we might try to argue or show somehow that we need one, right, you know, conception of prudence, you know, in the original position, say, and if we could show that, then this problem would dissolve. So I think you're correct about that. The question is which one, right? And how do we do that in without simply sort of begging the question in favor of, right, one of these rival conceptions? So people have made the point, right, that, or some allege, right, against Rawls, that the individuals in the original position are risk averse, right? So some have said, right, they end up with maxi min because, you know, they are worried, right, about being the worst off, so they want to make that person's position, you know, as high as possible, right? So suppose that we cast that as a sort of, you know, claim about prudence, or we try to use that as a kind of meta criterion for deciding which of these different conceptions is the right one. Well, which one's most risk averse? Rawls's economic conception, you know, the Buddhist non-striver, the temporal discounter. I guess I don't see a way to apply any criterion here that doesn't simply reinvoke one of the several, you know, controversial conceptions of prudence that, you know, we would need to sift through in order to solve this problem of indeterminacy. So I think that your sort of response is on the right track, but it seems to me it, at least so far as I've thought the issue through, it seems to me it sort of just hits a dead end. So, but I'd be interested in hearing, you know, more thoughts about that.
Okay, thank you very much to all the participants for sticking to the timetable.